stories from around the corner.
And around the country.
You're listening to All the Best.
Proudly supported by the Art Gallery of New South Wales.
You're listening to All the Best from FBI Radio 94.5. I'm Madhura Prakash. Before we get into this week's stories, I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that I'm recording from stolen Gadigal land and pay my respect to Gadigal elders past and present, and also recognize that the area where FBI Radio is situated, Redfern, has long been a place of storytelling, strength, resistance, and resilience for First Nations communities. There's a bit of a rebellious spirit to what we do at All the Best. We're big fans of community radio, and community radio has the potential for a radical DIY spirit that wants to make radio accessible to everyone. We encourage people to have a go, to experiment, to be unconventional and feel part of a community. On those terms, it's kind of punk-ish. In any case, in our first story, we're going to hear from five people looking back at their young punk selves and how the politics, music, and spirit of this community has continued to shape their lives. And just a heads up, it's the punk episode, so there might be some swears.
It's around 14, 15, things didn't feel right or fit in.
I've always felt there was something missing, and it's what, you know, looking back, I was searching for something that I wasn't getting.
Rebelling and questioning, like, what was going on around me as, like, a teenager, just being like...
You look for stuff that allows you to kind of release this, like, latent rage that I think a lot of teenage girls have.
Or, like, why are you telling me to do that?
But I think, especially as, like, a young teenager who was like, I have all these thoughts and feelings about things, but I don't know how to structure them or how to feel about things. And then here it was, it's like this community that's like, we care about certain issues and here's sort of what we're doing about them and here's how we're talking about them and here's resources.
The moment I heard, like, the Pistols and the Clash, I was like, holy shit, this is exactly what I need in music. It became, like, my guiding light.
Just invited me along to this show. Just met him and went along to this show and proceeded to meet basically all the people that I know in Berlin.
And I remember showing up to my first gig. Like, it was a pop punk show, but it was definitely that kind of overlap of audience. And I was 14 and I showed up and I was like, oh my god, all these people are like me. Like, just this, I saw the line outside the metro. I was just like, oh, I saw a whole line of people with, like, colored hair, a whole lot of, like, expression, really cool makeup, they were all talking, they were all being so sweet and lovely and inclusive, and I was this terrified 14-year-old. I had the, like, little red pigtails and, like, my first ever pair of boots that I'd got on, like, discount clearance that were tartan.
Like, I got into punk because through environmental activism when I was a kid, and all of these punks started showing up to, like, the country town where I lived to do forest protest, and there were all of these, like, hot people who were much older than me wearing all black with dreads and piercings and tattoos, and it was like, these people are sick, they're so cool. I wanted to be like them. I was like, you guys are so cool, I'm gonna be just like you.
When I first started going to gigs, I was 15. The moment I went to those gigs in London with my friend, you know, you go into these venues and it's just, oh my god, look at these people. They're all, like, full-on spiky hair, leather jackets, studs, freaking 12 million earrings, and the music was insanely loud. It blew our minds. We'd come out at 11 o'clock on midnight and just be, like, wide-eyed. Oh my god, what have we just experienced? We're just, like, the coolest kids in the world. We've been led into this amazing secret thing.
That all of this was existing the whole time and no one gets to know about it because it's not promoting itself anywhere. How many bands I'd never heard of and would never hear of without going to these sorts of gigs. And these sorts of gigs would be ones that happen at people's lounge rooms or, like, strange alternative spaces.
DM this person to get the details of, like, this DIY, like, garage show.
Being put on, and there were shows at, like, various different warehouses around the West. And this band was playing, and it was just like these queer women on stage just absolutely ripping. And looking around and the whole mosh was just women. You know, the punk bands would play and then there'd be like a queer DJ dance party.
But the moment anyone fell down, the crowd would part and you'd pick them up. And I was like, wow, because I thought it would just be mental chaos with no respect for each other, but it was actually really respectful of each other.
I am a, like, visibly trans and queer, and often when I'm at gigs, visibly disabled, I often use, like, a cane when I'm walking at gigs and, like, autism. But, like, I have complete trust in my community that if someone falls in a gig, you pick up the person next to you. Punk is both community and identity.
Maybe what I see as being uniquely punk is a acceptance and embracing of chaos.
I think when I think punk, the most like quintessentially punk thing is like fuck the police, like radical politics.
It's compassion for the person next to you and it is anger at the people that are pushing them down.
I think that there's like an attitude or approach to authority and questioning authority or status like at all times. For me, it's like a great leveler of all people and all things.
In England, I remember being a bit of a leveler as in terms of class, you know, divides. A lot of poor kids who couldn't afford housing or let alone buy an instrument inside a band themselves, but they were accepted into the community just like anyone else. So there was a real sense of overcoming poverty together, squatting.
Living on next to nothing when you're on the dole and sharing that with all your mates, like...
I was living in a share house with 12 people and our rent was fuck all.
Living together cheaply and being happy and kind of being free of that sort of class structure.
And it's some really cool music.
I think what might be more punk in this day and age is for someone to pick up an instrument that they don't know how to play. We were having a jam and I played the flute while we were recording something. And I don't know how to play the flute. Yeah, I played guitar for quite some time, but I'd never thought to play it in other ways, like with a violin bow. I guess maybe I would have never thought that it was okay for me to do it too. You can't quite separate punk from the political dimension.
And obviously the fashion is sick.
When I was probably 1920 in London, I definitely had like a big sort of bushy mohawk thing going on. Definitely had the shape, size, tons of earrings, nose ring. I tried to sort of just fit into the look.
And I started off a little bit more of an emo kid.
You know, maybe I was a bit of a gothy 80s retro person. I'd had my phases with listening to, like, I don't know, psychedelic music and whatever.
When I started getting more into punk, the floral dresses disappeared and there was a lot more of just black denim, you know, like tiny little shorts, big boots, shaved head.
Oh, it is totally joyful. Like, there are a few things that make me happier than, like, putting my hair up in a mohawk and, like, painting spiderwebs on my face and doing the whole thing. But it's, like, part of that joy is it's, like, I get to go be in a room full of other people that are also fully expressing themselves in the same way.
Particularly because so much of being a teenager is, like, being told to look and act a certain way, particularly when you're a young girl. To be able to go into a space where you're like, fuck it, I'm going to be dirty. I'm going to shave my head. I'm going to like wear things that don't match and have leg hair and armpit hair. And if someone looks at me sideways, I'll tell them to fuck off. Like, it's really fun and liberating.
There's plenty of like normal looking people or people that, you know, would have office day jobs during the week and then they go to a show on the weekend and they've got like heavy black eyeliner and they're wearing big stumpy boots and they're in a circle pit.
There's a lot of people who are very punk who probably don't look it or don't look it anymore.
But there's something called lace coding in punk, which is a regional thing that a lot of people will argue that lace code is dead, I counter that and say that if someone recognises it, it's not dead. But basically, it was a thing in the 80s where there was a lot of infiltration from, like, white supremacists, Nazis and stuff, and they would start signalling to each other that they were in these spaces by ladder lacing black boots with certain colour laces. So they'd have, like, white for white supremacists and stuff like that. But people would start lacing their laces in alternative ways, so different colours mean different things in a punk sense. So one of my laces is yellow for anti-racism, and one of them is purple for queerness. And I do that, well, partly as a signifier of sort of working actively on being a safe person. It's like a reminder to myself to uphold those values every day.
I often think that punk is more an ethos and a lifestyle.
The politics of punk attracts me more than, like, the music or the fashion. Like, there's kind of this anti-authoritarian, like, political bent where you've got to have a bit of chutzpah, a bit of fight in you. And, like, I think that's something that's really cool about it. It's not passive, it's really active.
And the aspects of it that I liked were people trying to build an alternative to the shit society that we live in.
It's not just one person yelling, it's a whole bunch of people yelling in an art form that allows us to have those conversations and say these things in a way that it's like, there is so much frustration and pent-up anger. We can't go into the email inbox of a politician and scream about it, but we can scream about it in a song and use that song to talk about emailing your reps and getting something done. Or dismantling the system entirely, depending on how far you want to go.
We see dudes everywhere all the time. And for me, punk was about subverting that and people who don't traditionally have power just getting up and yelling about the stuff that they have to put up with.
Lots of people wait to be told what to do. And I think coming from punk, like, you don't ask for permission to do it.
It tells you that you can do it too.
When I first formed my band, like, I totally was just like, fuck it, I'm going to form a band. And we just did it.
You'll see a lot of punks in activism spaces, at protests. You don't just talk about these things, you do things.
And I had a mate that was like, oh, I'm going to jump on a freight train and go up north, and we're going to go protest some for West Papuan independence in Darwin. We're like, oh, fuck, like, do you want to come? Like, oh, fuck yeah. And cut a hole in the fence and waited while the train idled up, and it rolled through these yards and just started traveling north. It felt really amazing. Like, you know, oh, it sounds so naff of, like, this thing of, like, freedom, going through the desert at night, with the sound of the train under moonshine. It's just like, it's a really crazy, unique memory that kind of really sticks with me. That's as punk as I got.
I like to think that some of these, I guess, morals or ways of approaching the world are things that I always had, but I also see them in punk. Crazy, strange things that are kind of made to, like, entice someone out of their comfort zone and, like, into some other experience.
That's what you're doing as a young person going into the world, then you're kind of testing the boundaries of what's out there. You're looking for experience.
Punk is not dead.
But I do think it had a really big impact on my identity and my life.
And understanding that this is a community and collective thing and not necessarily about any one individual over anyone else. And there's no hierarchy. It's dismantling that. It's dismantling power systems.
And now I work 9 to 5, and that's probably very anti-punk. But I still think that there's a sense of, like, the anti-authoritarianism and the questioning of social norms and those sorts of things that sticks with you.
Gone a long way in shaping what I value in music.
I like it when people stand up and speak out. I tend to avoid approaching anything in life by the rules or by the book if I can, if it suits me better.
It's important for punk to be there for other young people to move through.
Going to shows now as an adult where I'm like, there are younger people coming into this scene and I have a responsibility to make this a safe space, and that is an active decision.
Like, it's on this never-ending loop, like, playing itself out again and again and again and again.
Go find your local punk scene, people.
That story was produced by Mel Bakewell, with production assistance by Phoebe Adler-Ryan. You can catch Charlie on the Sunday Overhang and listen to Jasper on Wednesdays on Reel to Reel. Sometimes in life, we encounter people who are like a portal to another world, who show us a completely new way to be. In our next story, Laura shares how a chance encounter with a man at a grocery store unexpectedly changes her life.
The last time I saw him was on Old Street. He was standing balancing on his heels in the winter sun. The long shadows created abstractions of his long black coat with his tails and his top hat. And he grinned at me with that signature toothless grin. He was off to do a gig. He was always off to do a gig. In Soho this time. Some circus he was ringmaster. He winked at me and smiled as he turned on his heels towards the city. A few months later, I received a text from a friend I'd had a falling out with at Glastonbury. It was an apology, but not about what had happened between us, about Gary, about having to show me the news. The text had a link to a newspaper article in the Evening Standard, British family dies in car accident in Jamaica. It was apt that he died on the road. He was always driving, either travelling or living in vehicles. He was a driver when I met him. It was my first job in the UK. It was on a vegetable box scheme, and it paid £3.50 an hour. The work was easy, with morning, lunch and afternoon tea, all made and grown locally, and you got free vegetables. It kept you fed. Gary would always waltz in at delivery time, grumbling about never having enough food to feed his kids, looking for any scrap vegetables he could get for free. He was always grumpy, but underneath his manufactured discontent, there was a palpable mischief. It was almost as if the little kid inside of him was far too big for mundane adult life. When I was finishing up one day, we chatted while loading the boxes into the van. A crow flew past and he paused. He talked about the valley he grew up in Wales and how the crows had protected the valley. They were the messengers between the worlds, he said, and it helped to listen. His girlfriend Camilla was helping him to load boxes. She was my age, 27 at the time to Gary's 45. She was wearing a fluorescent yellow fur coat and high-top sneakers, a stark contrast to Gary's faded black shirt and jeans. We swapped numbers. A few months later, my life had fallen apart. I'd been attacked in my living room and had spent 3 months in fight or flight mode. My health was wrecked, I'd hardly slept, and every stray comment felt like an attack. I was just getting back on my feet when I got a call from Camilla out of the blue. What are you doing this weekend? Come to Bristol. There's a party we have a gig at. Sure. I had nothing to lose. I had never been to Bristol before. I also had no life and no friends. Gary told me he'd come and pick me up at 3 p.m. The next afternoon, a Mercedes van spray-painted from bumper to bumper with colourful graffiti arrived at my front door. I smiled as they jumped out and slid open the side door of the van to show me my seat. A red velvet lounge chair stood in the back of the empty van facing a small window. It wasn't strapped out. We headed off and Gary said we had to stop for fuel. We pulled into a Sainsbury's car park and to my confusion, Gary instructed Camilla and I to each buy 3 large bottles of vegetable oil. He sternly told us not to act suspicious, which felt novel to me. I had no idea how the van could run on vegetable oil, but I was pretty impressed nevertheless. Gary was adamant we could get into serious trouble, that if the cops saw us, they would book us if they could smell it. The potential of danger added to the growing wonder as to what the hell I was getting into. On an empty stretch of countryside, we pulled up on the side of the road and started pouring the oil into the fuel tank. Gary had just bought the van for their upcoming German tour. He'd fashioned it as a piece of the Berlin Wall, said he hoped to camouflage himself when he was in Berlin. He'd lived in Berlin for over a decade, squatting to live and play, And on the way down to Bristol, he asked me if I wanted to tag along on their German tour. The band were travelling around Eastern Germany, and they were all going in the van, and there was space for me if I wanted to come for a couple of nights. All I had was the gallery job I'd barely managed to keep when I was in fight mode. When we arrived in Bristol, we turned into a short street of about 5 houses. It took me a moment to realise that the party was the entire street. Every house played a different style of music, and they'd knocked down the small brick dividing fences in the backyard to make way for a huge stage and a bonfire. People were aged from 6 to 65, and more kept on arriving until the entire street was completely full. Just after midnight, Gary grabbed me. "Time to leave. It's getting messy." The red velvet lounge chair had been swapped out for a mattress, and so we all slept in the back of the van on the drive home. We arrived in Brighton at dawn. Gary asked if I wanted to go to the car boot sale in the car park at the station. "What's that?" I asked. "People sell their toot from the boots of their cars for pennies," Gary replied. The sun was rising, and I had no money. Gary bought me a tea, and we walked around. I found this beautiful 60s silver shift dress, which was £5 that I didn't have. Gary handed me a fiver, and the dress was mine. I was elated as he dropped me home. For the first time in months, I slept deeply. And when I woke up, it was with wonder and awe. It was the first time in a really long time that I was actually happy. We tend to think about power in terms of control, but Gary Bamford's power lay in the way that he made you experience the world. It was like he was narrating a version of the story as it unfolded around you. A world where the rules you thought were real didn't actually apply. Gary's way of seeing the world showed me worlds that I never knew existed, and it freed me from the confines of my own reality. His way of navigating the world to fit his desires was a reminder that nothing is what it appears to be. He called to see if I was coming to Germany. I booked my flights. When I left, all I had was a text from Gary to message him when I arrived at Ostbahnhof station. The whole journey, all I thought about was having nowhere to stay. But just as I got off the train, there was a little piece of the Berlin Wall. The door opened to let me in, and off we drove to the first gig. We slept in a gypsy caravan on the River Spree. After breakfast, we headed east. We drove through towns, forests, and farmlands. The sun was shining, and I was free. We got lost, we got found. They played a gig in an old tavern. Our bed for the night was in an abandoned brutalist building in the middle of the forest. The next day, with nowhere to be, Camilla and I ate lunch on giant thrones carved from long dead trees in the forest. That night, we drove back to Berlin. I caught my flight home. The next time I saw Gary, he came into my work with a proposition. There was a truck that would make the perfect mobile art gallery. It was a semi-trailer with glass sides and electricity. It only needed £500 to get on the road. We could screen films while driving, park up and do pop-up exhibitions. A million possibilities flashed through my mind. I was in. I enlisted Jimmy Courty, an artist famous for burning £1 million, and I brought him to the scrapyard to meet Gary. Afterwards, Jimmy was just so grateful to meet Gary that he thanked me. It was as if Gary was a dying star in a hostile universe. Each time after that I tried for a start date, Gary would stall. After a few months, I asked for my money back. It was gone. I was furious. I didn't hear from them, and I left it there. In 2010, I won an installation in the Shangri-La at Glastonbury. I was finally being paid to make art. The weather that year was glorious. I ran into Gary in the campsite the day before the festival began. He could tell I was still angry, and he handed me a beer as he invited me to a barbecue. The sausages on offer were handmade and reared from a pig fed entirely on apples from his friend's orchards. It was impossible to stay mad at him. It was seriously the best sausage I have ever eaten. We connected throughout the festival, and I spent a day running around with Camilla as we'd always done. At one point, Gary invited me for dinner. He took me to a very beautifully decorated Japanese restaurant in a yurt, and we were seated in a private room on tatami mats and served the best of their menu, all on the house. It was Gary's way of apologizing, a little luxury created by pulling some strings. It worked. All was forgiven. On the last night of the festival, I had taken some sketchy drugs. Wandering around the festival solo in my own nightmare, I ran into Camilla backstage in the Shangri-La. She gave me something to calm myself and then asked me if I wanted to join them on stage. It was 4 a.m. The sun was rising. Whatever she gave me took the edge away. I followed her up as she motioned for me to go on stage. Looking out at a packed-out crowd, the band began to play. It was the last of the late-night revelers on the last night of Glastonbury. The sky turned an eerie pinkish red. It was messy out there. The crowd surged and danced. People looked wild-eyed and lost as they moved to the music and the sun rose up behind them. The moon hovered above the artificial Stonehenge boundary. I was photographing the audience and the band and dancing and laughing. I was on top of the world. I had no idea what was happening. I danced in and around the band as they played and sang. I took photos of the crowd. And then it was over. A roar of applause, and we all headed back to our temporary homes. Gary died in a head-on collision with a pickup truck in Jamaica in August 2011, alongside his daughter Casey and his ex-partner Kathleen. Gary's wake began on Brighton Beach and formed a procession that travelled miles to a farm inland. Over 600 people turned up to mourn. 2 days later, it ended when a 50-year-old man was found dead in his van. A tragic tribute. Gary was 49 years old, a year shy of 50. And while I was sad at his passing, I've never felt grief. Gary was magic. He connected people and he created a space that felt timeless and full of possibility. He lived for his moments on stage and he burnt brightly. Just like the crows, he was a messenger between worlds, reminding us to stay free, whatever the cost. That story was produced by Laura Luck. The supervising producer was Dan Simo.
All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past and present. All the Best is made at FBI Radio on Gadigal land, in association with SYN and 3RRR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung and Boon Wurrung lands, and 8CCC on Arunde and Warramungu lands. The All the Best editorial producer is Mel Bakewell, and Phoebe Adler-Ryan is our executive producer. Our social media producer is Isabella Lee, and our social media assistant is Seth Emmerich. Patrick McKenzie is our community coordinator, and Janae Madden is our content assistant. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Art Gallery of New South Wales and the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find our full archive of more than 500 episodes at allthebestradio.com. I'm Madhura Prakash. Thanks for listening.